We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Untangle. I'm Patricia Karpus. Today, I'm excited to interview not only the amazing Dan Harris on his 10th anniversary for 10% Happier, but bonus, I interview his 9-year-old son, Alexander, towards the end of the show. I actually wanted to find out if Dan walks the talk, and indeed, spoiler alert, he does. And it was fun to see that his son shares his sense of humor. I think of Dan as part comedian, part meditation or self-help guru, and part real guy who shares all the messy stuff that shows up in his life. The stuff most of us hold inside. And while it's the 10th anniversary of 10% Happier, he's actually, he says, now more like 40% happier, something like that. Dan's books, podcasts, and meditations have helped many, many people. I love when he talks about his twin demons, anger and self-centeredness, and shares how he copes. Or the toilet vortex, a term his friend gave him for when we go down the rabbit hole of rumination. We discuss what has motivated him to uplevel his happiness and kindness game, how his 360 review while at ABC News helped him to see how other people actually experienced him, especially when he wasn't his best self, and how glad he is now that his most recent 360 is much, much better. Why has meditation moved from the realm of hippies into the mainstream? Science has stepped up to confirm what we all know, that meditation works, along with the many other things we've learned we should do to be our best selves. Dan's impact has been huge, changing lives by connecting so many people to these practices. Fun fact, Dan's favorite style of meditation, loving kindness. I can't wait to see what he does next, which he alludes to a little bit here. And as mentioned, it was a joy to interview his very funny son, Alexander. As always, we're Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain sensing headband dedicated to unlocking your brain's potential, and Meditation Studio, the 5-star app. Now over to Dan. Dan, it's great to have you back on Untangle. I'm thrilled to see you again.
Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
It's your 10-year anniversary for 10% Happier. And I can't help but thinking, could the revised edition have come out 30% happier or 40% happier? 10% happier after 10 years? What are people going to think about that?
I talk about this actually in the new preface I wrote. The publisher of the book did not have a lot of faith in the commercial appeal of the title. And so she tried to negotiate me up to 30% happier 10 years ago. That did not work. I stuck to my guns. But I get asked this question a lot about the math of it, and the 10% is a joke. But since I'm stuck with that joke now forever, I do think of it as a good investment that compounds annually. And I don't know where I'm at right now in my percentages, but it's way more than 10%. And the central message of the whole book and everything I've done subsequently is that happiness and other mental qualities we want are skills, not factory settings. So you can just increase over time.
Has your meditation practice changed over time? What has changed in you over the last 10 years?
10 years is a long time. So I've changed quite a bit. I know you're going to recruit some witnesses to see if I'm full of shit on the score. But I think the major development in my contemplative career and my meditation practice is adding in way more loving kindness or metta, M-E-T-T-A practice than I used to do. That has been a huge deal for me. So my practice daily usually starts with a good round of loving kindness, which if you think it would be helpful, I can define it and describe it. And then I move into mindfulness. And I think that just turns the dial in your mind, or at least in mine, toward warmth, which was not a factory setting for me. I'm definitely on the frosty New Englander side of the equation. So it's been very helpful for me to do that practice.
Let's talk about what it is so that people that don't know or don't practice it daily have a good understanding, and also of how you use it. Like you say, you wake up every morning and you try to start the day with that. What does that look like?
Yeah. So loving kindness practice was developed, my understanding is, by the Buddha himself and as an antidote to fear. And this is a well-established notion in many wisdom traditions that the opposite of fear is love. And as the story goes, I believe this was a practice that the Buddha developed for his monks who were often practicing by themselves out in the jungle. And there were lots of scary animals and noises. And the practice is a little, for me at least, annoying, at least initially. It can feel a little forced. But the way it goes is you start by bringing to mind visually or a felt sense in your body, an easy person, can be a little kid, can be a cat or a dog, or just a great friend. And you send four phrases: may you be happy, may you be safe, healthy, live with ease. And then you move in a progression from easy to yourself, to a mentor, to a neutral person, somebody you would overlook otherwise, to a difficult person, to all beings everywhere. And so for each of these categories, you're generating the image or the sense in your body somehow of your love target, and then you're sending these phrases. There's been a lot of science, a lot of research into what happens when you do this practice, and it's very interesting. It shows that it can have quite interesting physiological effects on levels of stress, psychological effects. So physiological effects on stress hormones, psychological effects on the experience of stress, anxiety, and then behavioral changes that, for example, this practice, when it's taught to preschoolers, it's been shown that the preschoolers are more likely to give their stickers away to kids they don't like. That is basically what's happening here. It's your training, your love muscle, which I know can sound a little dirty, but you're training your capacity for warmth. And it's easy for some of us with quote unquote easy people or mentors or somebody, people who've been good to us. But then as you get in further into the practice to train it up for people who you don't like, it's quite challenging.
Yeah. So you do this every morning?
My meditation practice, I'm not super regimented about it. I used to be very much improvisatory about it, in that I used to be an anchorman and I had a crazy schedule. And so I just fit it in wherever I could. Now I'm my own boss. I retired from ABC News. And on good days, generally speaking, I get up. Maybe I do a little bit of meditation before I get up, just in the bed. But I get up and I start writing right away. I'm 6 years into writing the sequel to 10% Happier, and it's just an all-consuming project. So I write for 90 minutes to 2 hours. Then I will meditate for 45 minutes to an hour. And then I will write some more, and then I will exercise. And then I will either go back to writing, or usually in the afternoons, I have a series of meetings. So that's what my schedule looks like now on days when I'm in control.
And what's it been like since you left ABC? How are you doing? Has your life changed a lot?
Yeah, it has. Traditionally, when people ask me the question, do you miss being on the news? My answer was no for the last 2.5 years, primarily because I did not miss getting up first thing in the morning. I was anchoring Good Morning America and on the weekends. And so it just destroyed my weekends. And I had to get up at 3:45, and that was pretty rough. And then during the week, I was anchoring Nightline. So I was just all over the place. And also, I mean, literally all over the place, in that I was being sent to cover breaking news. The fire went out for me on that. It's a kind of a young person's game. And I lost the fire in the belly for that. So there are a lot of things I don't miss. I do miss my colleagues. I had very close relationships there. And those relationships continue. I was just having dinner with two of my former co-anchors two nights ago. So those relationships are really healthy, but I don't get to see them the way I used to. And then in promoting the 10th anniversary of the book, I went back on Good Morning America. I went on The View. I went on a bunch of TV shows. And I realized that I actually really like being on TV. And I might go back and do some television. I don't know exactly what it'll be, but that was really fun for me.
Wow. I do feel like you're part comedian, part meditation guru, part human being who's willing to share his vulnerabilities. Totally see you continuing to share that in some way on air. I mean, is that the idea that you would do something related to meditation? Or
Yeah. Mental health writ large, probably. I like what you said, part comedian, part meditation person, part public figure who's willing to admit embarrassing shit. I think that's the recipe.
And so how do you think that's impacted your audience over the last several years? Those who have read your book, those who listen to your podcast, what kind of an influence do you feel like you've had, or would you hope that you've had?
Getting people interested in meditation, and I hear that a lot. I think there are several ways in which I hope that I've been useful to the audience. One is just putting meditation on the menu for people who otherwise would have reflexively rejected it. I think I do hear that from people, and that's pretty gratifying that I'm a skeptic, and the fact that you, a skeptic, are doing this thing made me think, oh, maybe I could do it. The other is giving people permission to be messy. I heard this term, cathartic normalization. I like that. Just basically the fact that I'm willing to talk about the uglier aspects of my personality. And I'm not the only one who does. There are many people who do this, but the fact that I'm willing to do that and alongside other people who are willing to do it just makes it okay to have struggles in your life. And then the third thing is, and this is increasingly important to me, is just being a platform for other people who know more than I do. On my podcast, which has 700 episodes or something like that, I get to hand the mic to people who are true experts. I'm a bit of a popularizer or an evangelical, but I get to bring on researchers and great meditation teachers and help them reach an audience. I find that to be very exciting.
Yeah, I think so too. And it's really interesting because you have had, I think, such a huge influence across the board. But I think especially with men, and I'm sure your audience is primarily women, I'm guessing.
It is.
As is ours. But I think in terms of who reads the book, I feel like a lot of women give the book to men because you're a very real person. And so those stories that you tell, they can relate to, and maybe it plants a seed of some sort.
Yeah, I think you're right that it's mostly women in the audience. But for the self-help genre, we have way more men than is usual. I heard one of, I don't want to say who it is because he didn't give me permission to talk about this publicly, but another guy who's in this space, he was describing me as like an unusual voice in the manosphere because I'm quite a bit less focused on optimizing. I'm all for being healthy. And if you want to track your steps, I'm cool with that. But I'm not a hardcore biohacker. And I also platform a lot of women and people of color on my show. And in that way, I'm on the touchy-feely aspect side of the male voices in the podcast world.
And have you always been like that?
I've been a barbarian in many, many ways throughout my life. My mom is a pioneering academic physician. So I grew up around a strong woman, and I ended up marrying, in a Freudian twist, a academic physician. And many of my best bosses and role models within ABC News and even in my local news career before that were women. So I think the show right from the beginning featured a lot of women. But I do think that I've gotten more sensitive over time. And I think a lot of my rough edges have been sanded down. They're still there, of course, and I remain capable of doing a lot of very dumb things. But the loving kindness meditation has definitely helped.
Oh, that's good. We'll talk about what you're calling the dumb things in a few seconds. But I thought it was really interesting on the interview you did with Chris Duffy, who's a comedian. And he was saying, hey, the hippies were right. Like the hippies 20 years ago were meditating. What do you think changed that? I think you're a big part of what has changed that. But I think there are probably a lot of factors that have made things like yoga and meditation more mainstream.
I can think of two factors. One is the science. I think that the fact that there's all of this data out there that shows that meditation is good for you. And it's still in its early stages, and sometimes it's controversial, so I don't want to overstate it. But I think it strongly suggests that meditation is very good for you. I think that's a huge part of it. And the other thing is just suffering. We are at record levels of anxiety, depression, suicide, addiction, and loneliness. And people are just looking for anything that makes life suck a little bit less.
I looked at your favorite podcast episodes, and they include things like emotional intelligence, anxiety, relationships, habit change. I listened to Esther Perel, the Gottmans, and I'm just super curious, as you interview different people, what are the nuggets? And let's just talk about relationships for a second, because those two really stood out for me, and I'm making my partner listen to them as well. Let's hope he does. What have you learned about being in relationship with both your wife and your son, but also your friends? You talk a lot about your twin demons of anger and self-centeredness, and we know those are like kryptonite for relationships. And I'm interested in what you would have scored yourself on a scale of 1 to 10 years ago, and how you'd score yourself now, and what some of the changes and influences have been for you.
The big thing was, I don't even know where to start here. This is a huge subject. This is the subject of my next book. So I have very strong feelings about relationships. I think of relationships in a very broad way, not just romantic relationships, but everything from your relationship to yourself, which is huge and really probably the key unlock, to relationships with random people, what scientists call micro interactions, to work relationships, to friendship, which is an art in and of itself, to family, to romantic relationships. And all of that I just bucket under love. And I think of love or relationships as a skill, a set of skills. This is not an original insight. What I'm thinking about a lot as I write my next book is that there have been some great books on how to do relationships better, external relationships. And there's been this great body of work pioneered by Dr. Kristen Neff on self-compassion, your relationship to yourself. What I'm trying to do is combine these two, which I have not seen done, and to think about love and relationships through that lens, and to think of it all as, if you're into self-improvement, this is the life hack par excellence, because the data show very clearly that if you want to live a long, healthy life, the variable that matters the most is not your sleep, it's not your exercise, it's not your diet. All of those things are very important, but the variable that matters the most is the quality of your relationships. The mechanism is very important there. Stress is usually what kills us, and relationships modulate and mitigate stress. So my message now, especially in the manosphere where everybody's trying to optimize, is you should optimize this. I've actually thought about calling the book Optimize This. This is the route to reduction of suffering. And for me, it really started with, I got a 360 review, which is like an anonymous survey of your coworkers. I added in my wife and some friends. And I did this in 2018. So I was already like an alleged self-help guru at this point. And it was not good. The results were not good. And I went hard at the deficiencies identified there, and then ended up getting another 360 3 years later. So 3 years ago. And it was completely different. I should probably get another one. Who knows? Maybe I've reverted.
No, congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So anyway, that's the next book. That's the story of the next book, is from the first 360 to the second. And the thesis is love is a skill, and it is the most important skill to learn. It's so funny that we are intensely social creatures. Every TED Talk reminds us of that. And yet nobody teaches us how to do relationships with ourselves or anybody else. We're not taught how to do it. And there are skills that you can learn, including loving kindness meditation, but other communication skills, self-compassion, which is a whole set of skills that I'm sure you've taken a look at. And look, if I can do this stuff, anybody can.
Yeah, well, it's super interesting, because what if there were curriculum in preschool all about love? Because it is true. We only learn it through the examples we have. And if we didn't have skilled parents, we may not have, you get to be 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, whatever, and you don't have those skills. It's really interesting when you do learn these things. And we did for Valentine's Day, and I know you had a lot of people on for relationships. So I did 15 interviews with past guests, just asking them 1 to 2 minutes, what's your definition of love and how does it express itself in your life? And it was great, but everybody had a completely different definition of it. It was really interesting, the different perspectives that people came from. So I think that's a good topic for your next book. And I like the spectrum too, right? Coming from starting with loving yourself and then bringing it out to everyone else.
I think of it as a spiral, like a virtuous spiral, upward spiral that you can access from either side. You can start with improving your own inner weather And that will lead to better behavior, and that will improve your inner weather even further, and up you go. But you can also start from the other side. One of the big recommendations for as an antidote to loneliness is service. Just being kind to other people and being deliberate as you're doing it, savoring it as you do it, that will lift you out of your own stuff too. It's interesting. There is this way out of misery that is available to us. And I think it's often overlooked.
Yeah. We had Bob Waldinger on the show.
He's amazing.
A couple of weeks ago. I loved him. And he was also talking about this, like, bar none. It's the quality of our relationships. It's not even how many we have or if we're married or not married. It's the quality of all of your relationships or each of your relationships. So you're spot on that.
Waldinger talks a lot. The term he uses that I love, because he's been on my show too, is social fitness. It's such a cool way to think about it. I am thinking about combining Waldinger with Neff. Because I think the part of Robert's work, he's a Zen practitioner, so he's not leaving out the internal work that needs to be done. But I think Kristen Neff really goes right at having a warm relationship with your own idiosyncrasies or demons, and has a bunch of practices that really improve your relationship with yourself beyond just meditation. So combining these two areas of research, that is what I'm interested in.
And I think I would throw Esther Perel into that.
Totally.
Dyad. That would be helpful too.
She's incredible.
She's incredible. Let me ask you a question. You mentioned in one of your interviews that I don't know if you were or are, you used the word dismissive. And I didn't really understand that. I might not have had the context, but what did you mean by you find yourself to be dismissive sometimes?
Well, the four critiques that were leveled in the 360 review back in 2018 were, if I can recall them, one was emotionally unavailable or emotionally guarded. So that's like the frosty New Englander thing. The second was, I think, something about being overcommitted, taking on too much, and that making me unpleasant to be around. All of these, by the way, are completely correct. The third, I've forgotten, but one of them was that I'm stubborn and dismissive. I think the third was that I could be rude to junior staffers, that I have a hierarchical view of the world and could overlook junior folks. And I came up in a star-based system at ABC News where I was hazed relentlessly, and I think I was unconsciously just repeating that behavior. So yes, being stubborn, dismissive, I think one way to think about it is closed-minded. I get a fixed idea and I'm just immune to arguments to the contrary. And I sometimes did this incredibly annoying thing of saying, well, I might be wrong here, and then just continuing to argue all the reasons why I'm not wrong. And I mean, I think that's a whole discipline in and of itself, open-mindedness. I think of it as part of social fitness. And not only in terms of your immediate relationships, but in terms of being a good citizen. Can you not just reflexively join your own tribal echo chamber on social media, et cetera, et cetera? Can you think about why other people might see the world differently? It doesn't mean you have to agree with them, but can you challenge your views, reconsider your views on the regular? Adam Grant has done some great work on this with his book, Think Again. I think this is something not enough people are taking seriously.
Yeah, I think it's great that you took it seriously and that you focused on the changes that you wanted to make, and that you had the self-awareness and the emotional intelligence to say, I want to be a better person. Because a lot of people you fix the behavior, you can be a little bit better to this person or that person, but you're not really changing your full self. So that's very cool that you took it seriously. You didn't have to. Maybe you did.
It wasn't my first instinct. My first instinct was to
defense.
Burn it. Yeah, defensive. I was super defensive. I don't know that it was talked about in the 360, but I would put that as another deficiency, being defensive, which I've also worked on. So I was super defensive. I was defensive, but then also just dejected. I was like, oh, I'm a fraud. I should quit this whole meditation promotion game. So I had a bad week. And then I started to have a bunch of conversations with people like Joseph Goldstein, who's a great meditation teacher I know you're aware of, and Sharon Salzberg and Mark Epstein, and my wife and my brother and people who are close to me who read the report and still love me. And then I started to feel like I could get a lot out of working on this. And of course, this is a great book. But I think, as my brother said when he read the report, he was like, all right, dude, now you got a good book.
It's a gift of getting. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. We talk about these often on Untangle. When we keep things bottled up inside, it can start to impact our health mentally, emotionally, and physically. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, whatever it is. If this sounds like you, and it's a bit of all of us, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule and needs. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now, over to Untangle. We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show. All of that insight. I want to talk for a second about the toilet vortex, and that's your expression or somebody else's expression.
I stole it from Evelyn Tribbley, who's the inventor of intuitive eating.
Okay. I like that expression, and I think it resonates with people. So I wanted you to talk a little bit about that and then the upward cheesy spiral.
The toilet vortex is this downward spiral that so many of us go into regularly where we're beating ourselves up and then we take it out on other people. And then because other people are so important to our mental health, our inner weather gets even worse and then our outer relationships get even worse. And it's just a vicious cycle. And that spiral remains on offer to me. I mean, I sometimes go down it still. The opposite is the cheesy upward spiral, which I just made that term up. And it's what I described before, that you, as your inner weather gets balmier, your outer comportment gets better, your relationships improve, and then you're happier, and then your relationships improve even further. And I can really see that. The last couple of years after retiring from ABC, for a bunch of reasons that I can't yet discuss because they don't involve just me, I'm always happy to discuss my stuff. But if it involves other people, I'm a little bit more discreet. But so for the last couple of years, for a variety of reasons, have been difficult. A lot of personal and professional challenges. And because of this upward spiral, they've also been 2 of the greatest years of my life. I just know now, having battle tested this a little bit, if you work on your relationships, again, writ large, capaciously, as inclusive of your relationship to yourself and then everybody else in the world and the world itself, it's a recipe for resilience.
I like when you say, get some distance from your own mind. You say, check your bad impulse in the moment, name the impulse, and that takes a bit of the charge out of it. You also say, just high five your demons and know that you can interrupt this.
I like the idea of high-fiving your demons. That's also something I've thought about using as the title for the book.
Oh, that's a good one.
I think there's this move that many of us make, which is we notice some obnoxious thought or emotion or whatever, and then we tell ourselves a whole story about how horrible we are. So we have this aversive relationship to our own demons. I know this is happening for me. You named them before. I think my 2 principal hobgoblins are greed and anger. And I would see a greedy impulse and I'd just tell myself a whole story about how I was thoroughgoingly rotten. And I think the move is to have some warmth vis-a-vis these demons because they are trying to help you. It's dysfunctional. It's like a misfiring of self-love, but it's some ancient program that is, to use the words of Jack Kornfield, the great meditation teacher, it's the organism trying to protect itself. So my greed or my anger is some 5-year-old version of myself doing its best to protect the organism. So if I actually like high five greed or high five anger, I don't need to listen to you right now. But that's a radical disarmament as opposed to the aversion, the trying to beat it out of ourselves, which actually just drives it underground and makes it more slippery and sneaky and stronger.
Yeah, I like that radical disarmament. What I struggle with is this idea that a lot of people talk about, which is, what does it mean to be authentic? Because sometimes people have that tug of anger and they think, this is just my authentic self, so I'm going to be my authentic self. So what's your thought on that? How do you give the microphone to the better parts of yourself and let that be your authentic self versus the flood of whatever might be coming out of you in a moment when you're triggered?
Look, anger sometimes is totally legit, and it can be clarifying. It can be energizing, get us off the couch. It quickly, for me at least, can cross over into, I think there's a healthy anger and then a destructive anger. And I believe this is talked about in psychological circles, so this isn't me just making it up. But it could quickly cross the line from healthy to destructive. I don't think what I'm talking about with high-fiving your demons is in any way to squash them or to say, no, I can never be angry. It's inappropriate. That would be especially dangerous to say to women who are socialized not to express anger, and I think in a very unfair and systematic way. I'm not taking anger off the table. If you can create a different relationship to it where you're seeing it clearly, one might say mindfully, and you're seeing it with some warmth, seeing that it's trying to help you, then you can take a breath, take a beat, pause, and decide, how do I want to handle this? In the cliche in meditation circles is respond wisely instead of reacting blindly. And I want to be super clear, especially to women or people who identify as women, that you don't want to strangle anger in its crib, because often it's a very powerful signal of something that needs to be fixed.
What are the most productive tools that you and Bianca use when you're in a conflicted situation?
It really depends. We don't actually fight that much. We probably should fight more. We had a few fights recently, a couple weeks ago. For 5 years now, I've done a lot of communications training, maybe even 6 years, with these great teachers, Dan Klerman and Mudita Nisker, who wrote a book called Let's Talk. And those communication skills are very helpful for me and have helped me avoid a lot of fights. Sometimes, actually, I'm just thinking back to our most recent fights. We did go at it, not like hammer and tong, but I think we let it all out and then took a break and then came back. And there's the moment of a fight, which for us is pretty rare. And then there are the communication skills that can prevent the fight. And that, I think, is quite common for us, that we are trying to hear each other out so it doesn't escalate.
So taking those tools into the hot topics that we're all dealing with, climate change, an election, wars, how do we integrate mindfulness into our thinking so that we don't feel so much tension and agitation around these different topics?
What's helpful for me is to really try, and this is a bit of a journalistic reflex, but for me, it's very helpful to try to understand why other people think the way they do. Like, I would not vote for Donald Trump, something I can now say because I'm no longer a journalist. I can say it in public, but I want to understand without vilification why other people would. So I find that very helpful, actually, because instead of wrapping myself in the seductive cocoon of anger, it's a little bit less comfortable in that it's more nuanced. I can start to understand, to challenge my own views and to reconsider as much as possible. So it's a little uncomfortable, but ultimately it's more satisfying because I'm less outraged and more, how do you want to be coming at these issues from a place of just blind rage? Or there's another alternative, which is, you could say love or warmth or compassion or caring or whatever it is. That's a cleaner burning fuel. So I can disagree with you, but it doesn't mean I have to despise you. And I think that just makes, for me at least, it feels more like I'm more effective in that mode than I am when I'm outraged. And I can feel it in like my own personal life. There are things where I can feel myself lapsing into real disgust or something like that. It does not help my judgment. It's just the opposite.
You can't change someone else's point of view necessarily. You might be able to over time, and you can't control certain things. But then we also hear, what about this idea that we can change? Is that mostly about ourselves and this idea of neuroplasticity? And how do you think about that? And how does mindfulness impact our ability to really change? And how is that for you? Let's talk more about you on that.
I think it's very clear that people can change. And I feel that I have changed quite a bit and continue to work on it. And it's not like an unbroken upward trajectory. It's a little bit messier than that. Roshi Joan Halifax, who's a Zen master who lives in the United States, she tweeted something or X'd something, whatever we call it now. It was an image of a very squiggly line. And then the caption was the path. And I like that a lot because that really, it's messy. But over time, I think with lots of bumps, you can improve and you can change and grow. I don't think you can do that for other people. I've tried. When I first got interested in meditation, I was pretty annoying with Bianca, my wife, about trying to browbeat her into it because she was in a very stressful job in the medical profession. And that totally backfired. So your uncle who likes the political candidate you don't like or takes the quote unquote wrong side in whatever international conflict is playing out right now, you're highly unlikely to be able to change his mind. But you can try to understand it. And that, I think, is compelling to try to understand the way people see things and to describe the way you see things. That's a much saner path.
We talk a lot about meditation. That's 10% Happier is mostly about meditation. But over the last 10 years, you have done a lot of different things. And you talk about this publicly, right? You therapy, you study Buddhism, you've studied in a hospice program, you meditate fairly consistently, you interview. I called you a meditation guru, you called yourself a self-help guru. So for people that were teaching them how to meditate, what is that ecosystem of tools that we need to be our best selves in your mind? It takes a lot. I just want to say it starts with this willingness. You had to be passionate about wanting to change.
Yes. I think you're right that I started 10 years ago really focused on mindfulness meditation with a side dish of loving kindness. And over time, I've really tried to look at the full repertoire of modalities for doing life better, which is broader. I think of meditation as foundational, but there are many other tools. I sometimes talk about what I somewhat facetiously call the pantheon of no-brainers. There are like 7 or 8 buckets of levers that you can pull. So in no particular order, meditation, therapy, medication if your doctor thinks you need it, access to nature, exercise, sleep, healthy diet, with the asterisk that I don't want you to get too wrapped around the axle on that. It's very easy to get dysregulated around food and just to what my friend Evelyn calls gentle nutrition, I think is the best route there. And then finally, relationships, which I don't think gets talked about. They don't get talked about enough. And those are the areas that I tend to consider when I think about how you can improve yourself. I would just add that, yeah, like I'm full time at this and I'm out here trying lots of stuff and trying to have a curatorial role so that people get a sense of what they can do in their lives. But I get that people are busy and it can be stressful to hear, oh my God, I got to work on all of these. I think you pick one or two, start really small. All the data around human behavior change strongly suggests that small steps, that's the way to go. One of the best-selling books, I think the best-selling book on the subject is called Atomic Habits by James Clear. And it's the little atoms, the little bite-size changes in behavior are what will get you there over time. And I always want to add that because I don't want people to get stressed out about thinking they need to like boil the ocean and get it all done now.
Is there anything else that you want to share? Anything that's new, top of mind, coming up?
I have a website where you can take a quiz and figure out what's the best meditation flavor for you. I've been joking that I'm 30 years late to the website game. I just launched my first one, danharris.com. You can take this little quiz that we built and that will point you in the right direction for what's the best kind of meditation for you. And then I will send you guided meditations from me so you can do it yourself.
Okay, perfect. So what are your 2 favorite books? You mentioned a few, James Clear and Adam Grant, but do you have any favorite books that you would recommend for our audience?
I think Self-Compassion by Kristen Neff is really good, and they give you the basics of that. And a great meditation book is Real Happiness by Sharon Salzberg. It's a great basic meditation.
Yeah, also with a lot of loving kindness in that. Okay, so if you had to give 3 pieces of advice to your 10-year-old self, what would they be?
Don't worry so much. Don't be a jerk. Those are the 2 biggies. As an adjunct to don't be a jerk, be very serious and diligent around cultivating your relationships in every sphere of your life.
That's a good one. Thank you. Dan, thanks for being with us.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So great to have you. Alexander, thanks for joining us on Untangle today. It's great to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me.
So I wanted to start by asking you a couple of things about what you love to do. Tell me a little bit about your favorite thing at school, whether it's sports or books, or what do you love?
Well, first of all, I hate school. Second of all...
Okay, good to know. You're like your dad.
Best part is lunch and recess. Second subject, I like reading. I despise math.
Oh. What do you not like about math?
Too many numbers.
Yeah, it can be so annoying. And what about animals? I know you have 4 cats.
I think that's too many. 3 is good.
Do you like them, or does the love of cats come from your mom and dad?
Both of them love cats.
And what about you?
But yeah, I love cats.
Oh, you do? Okay, what are the cats' names?
Toby, Ozzy, Stevie, and Curtis.
Oh, cool. Have you ever had a dog?
Nope, I want one.
Are you not a dog person?
No, I love dogs, but...
Just don't have them in the house. Well, how would you describe your dad?
All right. Author, former journalist, meditation guru / hippie, dad. Boring. IQ in the mid-50s, something.
Do you think you inherited his sense of humor?
Half of it.
Half of it. Okay, that's fair. What about emotionally? How would you describe him? Like using words that, is he happy, angry, joyful, frustrating?
Well, like me, like father, like son, he has a lot of anxiety, just like me, except we have very different, like he's claustrophobic. I'm scared of being alone. Like that's my main fear.
What helps you when you're feeling alone?
Knowing that there are so many people that can take care of me in my life.
Is that how your anxiety comes up when you're alone? Or do you have it like at school and other places?
At school. My teachers are very nice.
Yeah. Do you like talking in front of people? Are you like a presenter like your dad? Or does that make you nervous? You do.
Yeah. I have zero stage fright. My favorite thing in the world.
You're so lucky. You're more comfortable in front of people than you are alone. Okay, got it. Do you ever meditate?
Yeah.
And what kind of meditation?
Mainly loving kindness.
Do you do it with your dad or?
Yeah, he taught me it.
He taught you. Can you do it when you're alone, actually?
Yeah, I just don't.
Oh. Should I ask why not?
Don't feel like it.
Okay. Have you taught meditation to any of your friends?
I taught it in front of the local high school, my school, like a few times. That's all. And I've helped my dad do it in front of when he gives speeches in like Denver and stuff.
Do you guys co-teach at the high school and at your school and stuff like that? Or is it just you teaching?
It's just me.
Wow. That's impressive. Do you want to be a meditation teacher? Have you thought about what growing up means and what you want to do when you're older?
Yeah, that's not even in the top 50.
Okay.
Or maybe 50, but...
Don't tell your dad this, but I honestly think you might be funnier than him. Has anybody ever told you that?
I think...
Do you agree?
Yes.
When you talk to your friends, what do you tell them about what your dad does? Like when you say... He teaches meditation. Do they think that's cool or do they not really know what that is or what happens there?
Their face looks like, what's that? They look confused.
Confused. Yeah. So they don't really understand what that is.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. What happens? Maybe your parents or your dad never get mad at you, but when your dad gets mad at you, what happens then?
My parents haven't really been really mad at me. They've been frustrated.
Okay.
I'm not a big troublemaker.
No, you're pretty good. Good kid. And when they get frustrated, do they pretty much pause and talk to you about it? Or does your dad ever react poorly to you, in your opinion?
My mom does. Not really my dad.
Okay. I'm sorry. I just think you're funny, especially because you have such a straight face. And what happens when you get mad at one of them? What happens? What do you do?
Kind of like dying inside, but outside I'm more put together. Not saying I am, but
Can you tell them how you feel? Because you seem to have some good language for that.
Yeah, at the end.
Yeah. But not when you're first feeling it.
No.
Yeah.
I just end up storming to my room.
Yeah. Do you slam the door?
No.
That's pretty cool.
I couldn't hear the question.
When I'm angry, do I slam the door?
No.
Yeah, no.
So would you say you're calm?
Mm.
When you're feeling like that?
Calmer than other people.
Gotcha. So what advice would you give to kids about how not to be stressed and maybe how to be happier? What have you learned in your lifetime? And what would you teach?
Me and my dad are working. So this happened, started like 2 weeks ago. We're working on a kid's guide to meditation. It's like this book. And we have, how many meditations do we have on it?
It's your book.
I think we have like 11 or 12. We have like loving kindness, body scan, mental noting, which apparently is hard, walking meditation.
Do you write the meditations?
My dad tells me them and I write what he says.
You practice the meditations also?
Yeah.
Yeah, the ones that you're writing.
Oh, well, I do them after. I read what it says and I do it while I'm reading it.
Okay, so what is the secret? Tell me what you maybe will write in the book or what you feel right now. What is the secret to having a good relationship with your parents?
That's hard.
Yeah.
Kind of having like a brain fart right now.
Okay. Would it be like open communication or being able to fight nicely?
But you know what you do that improves your relationship?
What?
You're funny.
He is funny.
I wonder where I get that from. Saying it to you.
So what's the secret to a good relationship with your parents?
That's the parents' job.
Yeah, that's a good answer. And what do you guys do to have fun together, you and your dad?
We watch TV, we play catch, we take a walk. A lot of outdoor stuff.
A lot of outdoor stuff. That's fun. Do you travel together?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm his emotional support animal.
Okay. Alexander, is there anything else you want to share and give your wisdom to the world and to our audience?
Pretty much give all of it, but...
Okay. Well, I am really excited for your book to come out, and I would love to read it, even though I'm old. But I have lots of little children around.
It's for everyone.
It's for everyone. Okay, awesome.
But it's just less hippie. So kids can actually understand it.
Okay. So you do think your dad's a hippie?
Definitely. Except not like lives in a camper van on the beach and listens to John Lennon music.
He's not like that.
He's not like that.
Okay. Yeah. He's a good kid. Is that one of your cats?
Yeah. He's coming in. Ozzy, come here.
You want to put them on the screen?
Can you bring Ozzy up on the table?
Which one is this?
Ozzy.
Hi, Ozzy. He's cutie.
I know.
Yeah. Cats are sort of naturally chill.
He's meant to be like a only cat. Oh. Except just two brothers.
Bummer for him, right? Well, Alexander, thank you so much for being with us on Untangle. Honestly, I think you are hilarious and amazing. And I cannot wait to read the book.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being with us today. For more about Dan Harris, check out his website, danharris.com, his book, and his podcast, both called 10% Happier. Any questions, suggestions, comments, reach out to us at untangle@choosemuse.com. And we'd love if you'd write a review for us. It helps a lot. Have a great week, and we will see you next time.